Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 584, titled Rewriting History. This has been recorded on February 4th of the year 2007. Well, across the land, yea verily as I'm speaking, as I'm recording this, yea verily at this moment, people across the land are transfixed by the subject, by the event of the Super Bowl. People are no doubt watching that in vast numbers, far larger than the numbers who listen to For the Record. What we're going to be talking about during the course of this broadcast is the denial of history in one form or another, either creating an illusion which is successfully maintained, even against the onslaught of facts which would dispel that illusion, or rewriting history in the sense of attempting to deny what most people have come to believe, attempting to deny an historical truth. And we're going to be exploring not only attempts at rewriting history, but we're going to take a look at some of the political networking of some of the people that are attempting to do this. We're going to take a look, for example, at some of the political connections around the people who were involved with the recent Holocaust denial conference in Tehran. We're going to take a look briefly or by way of review at some of the people who were involved with the Bank al-Taqwa. We're going to be taking a look, too, at revising the history of September 11th and, in turn, using revised September 11th history to attempt to inculcate people with a false view of history with regard to a number of things, in particular revising the history of World War II, not just Holocaust denial, but also in particular attempting to pin World War II and the blame for World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is quite interesting, but there's a lot of that going on. We're going to take a look at Japanese attempts at denying the rape of Nanking. And one of the things that is going to underlie our exploration of the rewriting of history is the fact that by rewriting history, either by successfully maintaining an historical illusion, which is just that, an illusion and not fact, or by attempting to replace accepted facts with historical illusion, people stand to make a lot of money. Because at the bottom, at the foundation of the rewriting of history is an attempt, often a successful one, at cashing in and at deflecting people's understanding of who is really earning what and how. As we launch into the subject of rewriting history on this Super Bowl Sunday, February 4th of 2007, we're going to review an element from For the Record program number 304 called Illegal Procedure. That is about organized crime in the NFL, and it deals with the illusions that surround professional football, and in particular, the mythologization of football and Americana and the synthesis of mythologized football and Americana with politics. That synthesis was effected very nicely with the creation of Ronald Reagan's Gipper persona. Reagan, of course, wore the moniker of the Gipper, and it was one of the things that endeared him to people who to whom he was endeared, I guess. That moniker came from one of the parts that Reagan played. He played Notre Dame football star Frank Gipp, a.k.a. the Gipper, in the movie Newt Rockne All-American. It was that movie part, an illusion, which ultimately came to symbolize the reality of Ronald Reagan's presidency. And what we're going to begin with is by reviewing a section from For the Record 304, which in turn was reviewed in For the Record 465. And this concerns the reality of the Gipper as it can be verified from the historical record, and the myth, the rewriting of the historical reality to propagate the myth of the Gipper. The information that you're going to be hearing comes from the book Interference by Dan Mulday, and in turn this is excerpted from For the Record program number 304 from May of 2000. In the prologue to Interference, Dan Mulday writes as follows. Years before he became President of the United States, actor Ronald Reagan portrayed Notre Dame's George Gipp in the 1940 Warner Brothers movie Newt Rockne All-American. Gipp had died of pneumonia in December of 1920 after an illustrious college football career. His purported deathbed request to Rockne "Win just one for the Gipper," unquote, was used during a locker room pep talk and helped to inspire Rockne's 1928 team in its upset victory against Army. And as the Gipper incarnate, Reagan used the line to inspire voters to elect him to the California Governor's Mansion and later the White House. To those who saw the movie and listened to Reagan utter those now famous words, Gip epitomized the virtues of good character, sportsmanship, and the right way of living, unquote. History, however, now shows that Gip, a man of truly questionable moral values, probably never made any such request on or off his deathbed. That Rockne, who was known for grasping at anything to incite his players, had fabricated the incident, and that Reagan's movie further embellished the Gip-Rockne charade. Hollywood, which is notorious for cooking up such fantasies as the Gip-Rockne story, realizes that most Americans view sports as a vehicle of inspiration and entertainment. Thus, sports history is routinely manipulated. Left unquestioned, stories like that of the Gipper become permanent fixtures of Americana. Regardless of the facts, the American public continues to believe the legend of George Gipp's deathbed request to Newt Rockne. The difficulties in debunking the myth about one college coach and one of his players is an indication of the problems in dispelling the legends about an entire institution, particularly one as popular as football. Powerful forces in America have built empires around these myths, and the preservation of these empires and the personal wealth of those who own them depend upon the maintenance of the legends. In the Reagan movie myth of the lives of Rockne and Gip, there is one scene in which Rockne chases away a gambler who's looking for an edge. Rockne, played by actor Pat O'Brien, tells him, quote, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean, and it's going to stay clean," unquote. Considering that Gip, with the knowledge of Rockne, was a notorious sports gambler, the O'Brien quote perhaps best illustrates my point. To a large degree, the National Football League, the NFL, has become the embodiment of the Gip-Rockne myth. It has wrapped itself around the American flag and strutted into America's homes to the thrilling stir of brass and percussion music as the choreography of bone-crushing tackles in dramatic slow motion flashes across the nation's television screens. Based upon the illusion, the country's love affair with professional football has given sports fans confidence that the NFL is an institution unencumbered by corruption. And noting again what Newt Rockne said, or Pat O'Brien, playing Newt Rockne, said in the movie, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean and is going to stay clean." And the following anecdote concerns George Gipp, the football player whom Reagan played in Newt Rockne All-American. Grantland Rice, by the way, was arguably the most important or best-known sports writer of his day. Grantland Rice often told a story about an incident that occurred during the halftime of a 1920 game just before Gipp's death of pneumonia. Rice reported that he had been told by an assistant coach for the Irish, quote, "Being behind by 3 points, Rock was really laying into the boys. He had about finished, and Gip, standing nearby, asked me for a drag of my cigarette. Rock looked up and spotted Gip leaning against the door, his helmet on the back of his head, puffing the cigarette. Rock exploded. 'As for you, Gip, I suppose you haven't any interest in this game.' 'Listen, Rock,' replied Gip, 'I've got $500 bet on this game, and I don't aim to blow any $500. Unquote. That again from For the Record program number 304 from June of 2000, the text again excerpted from Interference by Dan Mulday. We're going to proceed now from the successful propagation of a myth, a successful rewriting of the history of Frank Gipp and early Notre Dame football, and that the extension of that rewritten history to the political persona of Ronald Reagan. And we're going to take a look now at an attempt at rewriting history in the Middle East. And what is significant here, I think, is not so much the actual statements of the participants in this particular conference, but rather what this conference constitutes in terms of a political phenomenon. This conference concerns a Holocaust denial conference that was recently held in Tehran. Specifically, it was held in Tehran, Iran, in December of 2006. Among the many newspapers that carried a story about that was the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 12th of 2006. This is an article by Nazila Fati of the New York Times. It's Dateline Tehran, headline, World's Holocaust Cynics Get Their Chance to Vent. Subheaded, ex-KKK leader Duke, a speaker at caucus in Iran. It reads in part, Iran held a gathering that included Holocaust deniers, discredited scholars, and white supremacists from around the world Monday under the guise of a conference to, quote, debate, unquote, the Nazi slaughter of 6 million Jews. Among those representing the United States was former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, whose prepared remarks, issued by the Iranian Foreign Ministry, said the gas chambers in which millions perished actually did not exist. Robert Faurisson, an academic from France, said in his speech that the Holocaust was a myth created to justify the occupation of Palestine, meaning the creation of Israel. Skipping down. In another development Monday, Iranian students staged a rare demonstration against President Ahmadinejad, lighting a firecracker and burning his photograph as he delivered a speech at their university, the state news agency reported. Ahmadinejad responded calmly when a small group of students in a crowded hall at Khmer Tabir Technical University started chanting, "Death to the dictator," unquote, the Islamic Republic news agency reported. One held up a poster that read, quote, "Fascist president? The Polytechnic is not a place for you," unquote. Well, apparently at least one person who's not afraid to identify Islamic fascism for being what it in point of fact is. And as we talked about last week in For the Record 583, Islamic fascism is very real. However, it can only be understood in terms of its relationship to the post-war, well, to the fascist international before, during, and above all else after World War II. Still more about the Holocaust Conference. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of the following day, Wednesday, December 13th of 2006. This from the Chronicle News Services, and this article is datelined again, Tehran. Headline, Iran's leader predicts the extinction of Israel. Iran's hardline president said Tuesday that Israel will one day be wiped out, unquote, as the Soviet Union was, drawing applause from participants in a conference casting doubt on the Holocaust. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's comments are likely to further fuel the outcry prompted by the two-day gathering, which has gathered some of Europe's and the United States' best-known Holocaust deniers. Anger over the conference could further isolate Iran as the West considers sanctions in the standoff over Tehran's nuclear program. But Ahmadinejad appeared to revel in his meeting Tuesday with conference delegates, shaking hands with American participants and sitting near six anti-Israel Jewish participants dressed in black ultra-Orthodox coats and hats. Quote, "The Zionist regime will be wiped out soon, the same way the Soviet Union was, and humanity will achieve freedom," unquote, Ahmadinejad said during Tuesday's meeting in his offices, according to the official IRNA news agency. He called for elections among, quote, Jews, Christians, and Muslims so the population of Palestine can select their government and destiny for themselves in a democratic manner, unquote. He also suggested that the work of the government-sponsored conference, billed as a chance for, quote, both sides, unquote, on the Holocaust to be heard, should continue with formation of a committee to determine whether the mass killings by Nazis of Jews and others really happened. Ahmadinejad has used anti-Israeli rhetoric and cast doubt on the Holocaust to rally anti-Western supporters at home and abroad, particularly in Asia and the Middle East. Several times he has referred to the Holocaust as a myth, unquote, used to impose the State of Israel on the Arab world. By the way, I would note in passing that among the people, in addition to American Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, Robert Faurisson, one of the people discussed here, is not only a well-known French Holocaust denier, but an individual whose efforts in the past have been significantly assisted by none other than Noam Chomsky, the MIT professor, and arguably the brightest star in the American left cosmology, such as it is. Chomsky wrote a glowing introduction for one of Faurisson's books. Has later equivocated about what he did and why he did it, but he referred to Faurisson as, quote, an apolitical liberal, unquote, and saw no indication that he was an anti-Semite. Faurisson, again, basically is a neo-Nazi, and not only that, but an associate of the Old Mole publisher, the Gray Mole publisher, I should say, in Paris. And that is a milieu that, among others, involves people connected to Ahmed Huber and Horst Mahler. Horst Mahler and Ahmed Huber are two fellow travelers on the German neo-Nazi scene who also have a history of involvement with not only left radicals, but Islamists and neo-Nazis as well. Ahmed Huber, by the way, is a member of the board of directors of Bank al-Taqwa. He has been very, very close to the Iranian regime. Ahmed Huber also represents something of an historical tie-in between the fascism and the Islamic fascism of the World War II period and the international fascism and Islamic fascism of the contemporary period as well. Huber was a protege of, among others, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Hussein, also a fellow named Omar Amin von Leers. Von Leers, originally named Johann von Leers, was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry in World War II. He later moved to Egypt, changed his name, and converted to Islam and became the head of Nasser's Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote. Ahmed Huber, again, is a member of the board of directors of Bank al-Taqwa. Huber is also someone who liaises between Islamists and American and European neo-Nazis. I would note, too, that as we looked at in For the Record 352 and as we reviewed in For the Record 456, the Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran, his exile in France while he was waiting to come to power was financed by none other than François Genoux, one of the most important Nazi spies before, during, and after World War II, a fellow who has been deeply involved with the far left, deeply involved with post-World War II Islamic fascists, deeply involved with the Bank al-Taqwa milieu. François Genoux also is the heir to the collected literary works and political last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And Ahmed Huber was very close to Genoux, Ahmed Huber very close to the current Iranian regime. Still more about this Holocaust denial conference. San Francisco Chronicle the next day, Thursday, December 14th of 2006. This also is a New York Times story. This is Dateline, however, Cairo. Its headline, Iran leader uses conference on Holocaust to push agenda. Subtitled, he seeks to spotlight what he sees as Western hypocrisy on issue. Again, this is a New York Times article by Michael Slackman. And skipping down, speaking of this Holocaust denial conference, the two-day meeting included no attempt to come to terms with the nature of the well-documented Nazi slaughter, offering only a platform to those pursuing the fantasy that it never happened. In addition, the organizers of the conference, a small circle around the president, have been building ties with neo-Nazi groups in Europe. This last sentence again. In addition, the organizers of the conference, a small circle around the president, that being the president of Iran, have been building ties with neo-Nazi groups in Europe. So this basically is what you've got here. You've got the president of one of the world's foremost petroleum-producing countries in the world, who is basically making a push for nuclear weapons. The notion that the Iranians need this to produce electricity is quite simply laughable under the circumstances. Iran, by the way, in addition to its oil reserves, has the world's second-largest proven reserves of natural gas. That is the generating fuel of choice, so to speak, for electricity. They do not need nuclear weapon energy for anything other than nuclear weapons. By the way, it's interesting to contrast what one hears about this in the so-called progressive sector in this country and reading the foreign press. The foreign press has had quite a few op-ed columns by people, many of them of Iranian extraction, who have experience with Iran's history. and have noted that Iran wants nuclear weapons basically as a safeguard against having weapons of mass destruction used against it, as they did in as they had used against them in the Iran-Iraq war. Or at least that is the rationale that apologists for that regime are providing. But even people who are sympathetic to Iran's drive to acquire nuclear power are not under the illusion that they're doing this for peaceful purposes. So what you have basically is you have a Holocaust-denying, apocalyptic, philosophizing president of an oil-producing, a major oil-producing country who is hanging out with neo-Nazis, denying the Holocaust, hanging out with leaders of the Ku Klux Klan, and pushing for nuclear weapons. And the world doesn't seem to be able to do anything about it. Well, this is what it was like in the run-up to World War II, where obviously there was a situation that was out of control, but because of economic factors, in this case the fact that Iran, for one, has a lot of oil, and two, that Israel's opponents, and in general people who are anti-Semitic, are quite sympathetic to the Arabs who have a lot of oil. And so a regime that basically should be defenestrated from an international diplomatic standpoint is instead basically able to thumb its nose at the world community. And I suspect that ultimately this situation is going to play out into some sort of cataclysm of one type or another. It's also unfortunate that the U.S. engaged in its utterly foolish and enormously self-destructive adventure into Iraq, because it has really blunted, not only done terrible damage to the U.S. diplomatic situation abroad, it's done terrible damage to the U.S. economy, it has done terrible damage to the U.S. military, it also has blunted what, for lack of a better term, might be the national will, at a time when we could use a strong military and a strong national will. But instead, we plunged into a war into which we should not have plunged. And now, with a real threat on the horizon, it does not appear to me that we're going to be dealing with it. And indeed, have we even got the military wherewithal to do so at this point, after what has taken place in Iraq? Short of going nuclear, so to speak, who knows? But at this point, the situation is, well, shall we say, depressing. It remains to be seen exactly what develops, but it does not appear to me that the world is ready to recognize what is going on in Iran for what it really is. And when you have a Holocaust-denying Islamic Nazi, which basically is what Ahmadinejad is, not only that, but one who believes in an Islamic end times philosophy of the coming of the 12th Imam, that's a really poor mixture with atomic weapons. But Holocaust denial is the order of the day in Tehran, and it's setting something of a pattern around the world. We're seeing a fair amount of denial of history. At some point, I'm going to do a sequence of programs about the September 11th disinformation movement, but perhaps one of the most striking examples, not only of the rewriting of history in and of itself, but also using that as something of a breach in order to begin rewriting history of the past, that is the September 11th disinformation movement. There are a number of researchers of various types out there who are doggedly and heroically pursuing the truth concerning September 11th, but unfortunately, the very real and consummately sinister realities concerning the conspiratorial process at work in September 11th have been obscured to a large extent by a tremendous disinformation effort. In particular, people grouped around the controlled demolition disinformation and similar gambits have very effectively covered up an enormous crime, and an enormous crime in which some very powerful people in this country and some very powerful people abroad are implicated. Leaving aside the actual disinformation concerning controlled demolition, whether the allegations of cutter charges or the allegations of thermite, the fact of the matter is that a controlled demolition involves high-speed reverse architecture, and in order to do it, you have to gut the building that is being demolished. You have to remove I-beams, staircases, entire walls. It is almost as involved a process as the actual construction of a building. And quite simply, they weren't removing the walls and the I-beams and the interior staircases of either the Twin Towers of World Trade Center 7. What did take place, we'll be going into at a future point of discussion. But I would note that quite simply, something that was viewed by a great many people around the world, live or via tape, is now being revised. And we're going to go into the major fallacies in the controlled demolition canard and related disinformation points. But what we're going to be focusing on for the bulk, for a nice chunk anyway, of this program is the way in which the September 11th disinformation movement basically marketed, most inappropriately as a 911 truth movement, has served as sort of something of a coattail in order to drag other fascist disinformation elements into public discussion. What we're going to be doing, and we're going to get into this primarily on side two of the program, we're going to be taking a look at a book which has had quite a bit of traction in the September 11th, quote, truth, unquote, community. That's a book called The War on Freedom, subtitled How and Why America Was Attacked, September 11th, 2001. This book was authored by someone named Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. This book and he, again, are quite well known in the September 11th, quote, truth, unquote, movement. The book itself isn't too bad. I mean, the September 11th itself is an extremely complex event, and in past discussions I've compared it with the old story about three blind men and an elephant. One has hold of the elephant's tail, one has hold of the trunk, and one has hold of one of the elephant's legs, and all three men have a very different impression of what the reality of an elephant is. September 11th is complicated, and the main body of the book, The War on Freedom, is not too bad. I'm not going to deal with it, but it is, I would say, an inadequate treatment of the subject. But it's not heinous. That's, I guess, about the best, most gracious way of putting it. But there is an afterword, a backword, which is actually kind of an appropriate title to this book, and particularly because the main body of the book, The War on Freedom, isn't too bad. The backword to this book is pure, unadulterated fascist propaganda. And it is by somebody who's named John Leonard. I've never heard of this particular individual. But the backword to the book, The War on Freedom, is using basically the awareness that there was a very profound conspiratorial process at work in September 11th, and that some of the major conspirators were on the inside. Not all of them. Not even most of them, but a nice chunk of them. And it's using that awareness to basically justify some of the worst conspiracy theories around, basically to push outright fascist propaganda. I think ultimately you're going to be seeing a fair amount of overlap between some elements of the 911 disinformation movement and the Holocaust denial movement. We'll see the extent to which that actually develops. We're going to be talking about the War on Freedom, however, in side two of this broadcast. Please be aware of the vast and growing amount of information available on the Spitfire website. First of all, the four most recently recorded For the Record programs are available in real audio and MP3 for download only on the Spitfire website. I turn each For the Record show into a long article-length description. There's an entire library, sort of a mini-library of old anti-fascist books available for free, and many linked websites with a vast and growing amount of information. There are lectures, archive shows, For the Record broadcasts available on audio file, a tremendous amount of written information, so please take advantage of that. It's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and if you don't like what you see, no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 584, Rewriting History. This has been recorded on February 4th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.